The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I wanted to talk tonight about one of the really foundational teachings of the Buddhist practice, and that's the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. This teaching is, and sometimes it seems like it's just basic, but really it encompasses all of the Buddha's wisdom, everything that he learned in his own journey. And it's framed around this question, the Four Noble Truths, is framed around the question of suffering. And so that maybe makes the Four Noble Truths seem depressing. I mean, it's like sometimes people feel like, oh, those Buddhists, they only talk about suffering. But really, the Four Noble Truths are a statement. The first two Noble Truths are a statement of there is suffering, the truth of suffering. You know, there's no life. Every life has some suffering in it. And the exploration that the Buddha made is like, is it possible to live a life with some ease, some peace, some freedom from suffering? And he found that while it's not possible to live a life free from unpleasantness, it is possible to have a life that's free from what we typically call suffering. And so I'll talk more about that in a moment. What we typically call struggle in our lives has more to do not necessarily with the fact that things are unpleasant or that pleasant things impermanently disappear on us, but that we are basically trying to hold on to things that are pleasant, not wanting them to go away, or trying to resist things that are unpleasant. And so it's the movement of mind, the reactivity of mind around what's happening in the world, where most of our suffering happens. And that's a hypothesis for you, perhaps, to hold on to for just a moment. I'll talk more about that in a moment. So the first noble truth is that there is this suffering in our lives, and the second noble truth is that the suffering that most affects us is the suffering that is created by our mind's relationship to what's happening. The second noble truth is stated that craving is, you know, with the arising of craving, there's the arising of suffering. And this craving, basically, the craving around wanting to get rid of things that we don't like or hold on to things that we do like, that this craving is the craving that creates the suffering, the struggle in our lives. So these first two noble truths are kind of an expression of a normal way that we relate to life. You know, we like things. We want to hold on to things that are pleasant. We don't like certain things. And when things are unpleasant, we want to get rid of them. This is just a very familiar way of navigating the world. And yet the Buddha, in his exploration to look, is it possible to be free from suffering? He found that that very movement of wanting things to be other than they are, other than that they have come to be, wanting things to be other than they already are, that very wanting is the source of our struggle. And that when that wanting what already is to be otherwise falls away, there's a lot of peace. There's a lot of ease. There's a lot of joy in our lives. And so the first two noble truths are kind of a statement of the way suffering comes to be. There is suffering, and that craving moves us in the direction of that struggle in our lives. And the second two noble truths, the third and fourth noble truths, are basically the statement that it is possible through The ending of that wanting things to be other than they are, for there to be happiness, for there to be peace, freedom from that struggle. And the fourth noble truth is that there is a path, a set of practices, conditions that we can engage in that will help to lead us from our habitual way of engaging in the world, of navigating this push-pull of wanting things to be otherwise, to orienting towards a new relationship with our experience. And I want to take a moment here to talk about that new relationship, because, you know, just even saying, you know, that wanting things to be other than they are is the source of our struggle. You know, a question comes up, well, you know, why wouldn't I want this world to be other than it is? It's a mess, right? I mean, so what does it mean to let go of that wanting? What is it? What is actually meant by that? To me, it's what is not meant is that we kind of just move into indifference mode, and say, "Oh well, things are as they are." You know, what I'm supposed to do is to not want it to be otherwise, and so that means that I don't do anything. To me, the peace of the third noble truth, the peace that the Buddha talks about that's possible as we let go of wanting, is not the peace of inaction. It's a peace that allows for a heart to respond out of compassion, out of kindness, rather than out of this push-pull reactivity that we typically engage in. And so this second noble truth that wanting, this wanting things to be other than they are, is the cause of our suffering. I understand that if we look at what is here now, what's already here, the world as it is, as it has come to be in this moment, what's already here? What's already here is a mess. I mean, that's pretty clear that, you know, there's terrorists blowing up airports in Brussels, and racism, and people dying of cancer. And I mean, all of this is what the Buddha called suffering. And that has come to be. What the way things as they have come to be, what has already come to be, that is what we are asked to not want to be otherwise. I mean, to recognize, basically, to align ourselves with the truth, this is already here. Resistance to that is futile. Resistance to what already is kind of running counter to reality. And so we are asked to recognize with our hearts, yes, this is the state of things. To not resist, this is the state of things. To allow our heart to be open to this is the state of things. You know, in some ways we feel like if we're resistant to the state of the world, then that's what will motivate us into action to change things. And there's a kind of shift of perspective around the Buddha's teaching, which encourages us to open our hearts to things as they are, or things as they have come to be. And in that opening of the heart, a different kind of motivation arises. Because that heart that is not contracted or closed down around the way things have come to be or what has come to be, that heart resonates, moves with responds to both the suffering and the joy, the connection, the kindness that is in the world. And so the heart that can open to things as they have come to be, I talked about this the other day, is kind of like the heart of that's like jelly. You know, jelly kind of just responds, it jiggles. And that jiggling of the heart creates the incentive for action, not out of fear, out of confusion, out of greed, out of anger and resistance, but out of that resonance. When that open heart experiences someone suffering, that open heart wants to respond and act with compassion. When that open heart feels somebody who is having good fortune, that open heart responds with joy and kind. And so this second noble truth about understanding that craving is the cause of suffering, it's not about letting go of momentum to act in the world. It is that we familiarly act out of wanting. And that's a way that all of us have organized our lives, many of us, so that, you know, we act because we want things, we want to do things, we want to have things, we want to get rid of things. And sometimes it feels like that our very motivation for acting is going to only come if we have greed or aversion in our minds. And this shift of perspective that the Buddha offers is asking us to trust, basically, that if we let go of the resistance to things as they have come to be, that a different kind of action will result. The heart can be at peace and act in the world to alleviate suffering. The heart can be at peace and act to protest about climate change. The heart can be at peace while doing that. So that's a piece I really wanted to say, because so often as we talk about this understanding of letting go of wanting, it sounds like, I mean, it can be heard, it can be understood as it means let go of wanting to do anything, that we just end up being like these, you know, people on a mountaintop who just sit there, you know. But that's not what happens. That may happen for some people. I know some monks in Burma who are just in their monasteries practicing sitting and walking. And, you know, that's the way that the Dharma is expressing itself for them. And yet they talk to people. Talk to me, for instance. I go and I talk to that person and I get inspired by his deep peace. And I carry it out. So there's room for all different expressions of the Dharma, all different expressions of that peace. For some, that peace may be very active. For others, that peace may be very quiet. So there's room for very individual expressions of what freedom means in this practice. So the Four Noble Truths offer us this kind of a shift of perspective around what's possible for us as human beings. The fourth noble truth I'll just talk about briefly. I just kind of laid out the first, second, and third noble truths. Just to restate them, the first noble truth, there is suffering. The truth of suffering. This suffering that we can be freed from is a result of wanting things to be other than they are, that is, things as they have come to be other than they already are. And that it's possible for that craving of things to be different than they already are to be released. And that release will be experienced as peace. That peace, again, the word peace we often think of as being potentially non-active, but there's a kind of very active peace that's possible. And then the fourth noble truth is the path, the way that we cultivate the possibility for this peace. And this is the Eightfold Path, and it's composed of wise view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And these are essentially qualities of mind. It's understood that we cultivate this path. We cultivate these practices which support us moving from the way we habitually engage in the world to this new perspective. Essentially, looking at suffering by using these tools and these qualities of mind changes that suffering, what we're experiencing is suffering, from being a struggle in our lives to being the compost out of which our practice transforms. So this, the Eightfold Path, are we can think of them as both as practices and as qualities. The first two, wise understanding and wise intention, are kind of how we have to orient to begin. That this perspective that I described around the Four Noble Truths, that's basically wise understanding, right understanding, the first factor of the path. We have to start somewhere. We have to start with some understanding of what the direction of the path is. And with that perspective, it may inspire us to engage. It might inspire us to begin to explore, well, what do these teachings mean anyway? And for me, as I really, at one point in my life, deeply descended into suffering, somebody sent me a book about the Buddhist teachings. And, you know, before that, I had basically just been trying to do whatever I could to be happy in my life, most of which involved trying to accumulate possessions that I liked and to acquire or become a person that I thought other people would like. And that process, you know, my own way of navigating the world, apparently, you know, at this point in my life, it's like, I've tried everything. I know how to be happy, and this is not working. What do I do, you know? And the texts actually say this in a classic way. They say somebody who is experiencing this kind of suffering will say, does somebody out there know a way or two out of this suffering? And into that context, somebody sent me a book of the Buddhist teaching. So I was at a place in my life where I was ready to try anything. You know, it's like nothing else has worked, you know. And I read this book and did not have a clue how it would work. I mean, it's counterintuitive what we talk about with respect to letting go of the wanting. You know, it's like, huh? I've oriented my whole life around wanting. I've been told wanting is the way to happiness. How is letting go of wanting going to do any good? But I had hit so much depth of suffering that I was willing to explore it. And so there was something in this book that spoke to me, something that enough confidence came through this book that I was willing to engage. And so this is this movement of right intention. We hear some teachings, and whether or not we understand them, something about it orients us to stepping onto the path with action. In my case, it was beginning to look at my reactivity of mind in my daily life. That's how I began my entire practice. I was not interested in meditation, but I was interested in exploring the mind and why it was so angry all the time. And so that's where I began, just stepping onto the path with some of the tools that this book suggested. When anger is arising, just know that you're angry. Again, had no clue how that would work. But within a very short time, it became more clear to me how this whole thing works. And so that little leap of faith that takes us from the understanding, the perspective that's offered, to taking action. My own experience, both in teaching and in my own practice, has shown that it doesn't actually take too much time of engaging for there to be some feedback about how helpful these tools are. So we step onto the path. That's what we do with wise intention. And then as we also begin to explore this question of suffering and maybe begin to orient towards suffering being, a kind of key issue in the world, we begin to want to orient our hearts towards a direction of not creating harm or suffering for ourselves or for others. And so this is the next section of the Eightfold Path, that when we step onto the path, we also are encouraged to engage in the world. So to me, this is a beautiful part of the Eightfold Path too, that it begins with this wise understanding and wise intention to begin to step onto the path. And then it's not just about closing your eyes and like shutting the world out. It's about engaging. It's about finding ways to relate to people from a perspective of wanting not to add harm or suffering in the world. And so finding ways to speak skillfully, finding ways to act skillfully so we don't create more harm, finding ways to have a livelihood that doesn't add harm in the world. And so the Buddha encourages us to relate. I find this to be a very relational teaching. It's not just about meditating. It's about exploring how we are in community, in relationship as well. And so we explore that aspect of our lives, the relational aspect. And then in the last section of the Eightfold Path, the last three, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, we're also encouraged to look back into our own lives, into our own experience, and begin to understand how our own struggles happen. How does our own inner, like the example I started with my anger, turning towards, one of my early insights around that, it's like I was asked to turn towards, well, look at the anger, know that anger's happening when it's happening. And it did not take me very long to recognize, ooh, anger hurts. This very movement, we begin to look into our own hearts and minds, we start to see what contracts the heart, what hurts our own hearts, and what allows our heart to feel more open, more connected. So this movement of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration asks us to look at our own hearts and minds, to witness what's happening for us. Sometimes that will be challenges and struggle. Sometimes that will be love and kindness, to just be aware. And one of the things that I'm really finding supportive these days is just to begin to recognize, with the tools of wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, is the heart closing down or is the heart opening? When the heart is closing down, we're not trying to bust it open, but we're looking at that. And we're recognizing many of the things that close the heart down are habitual. Many of the things that close the heart down are things that we have been taught in our lives were the way to happiness. And so the exploration around this with wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration begins to give the heart an education that the way it thought happiness was going to be found is not necessarily the way the organism, our organism, will find a truer, deeper happiness. And I think that our whole system, I mean, one of the great things about both mindfulness practice and about our humanity is that this human organism wants to move towards well-being. I think it's designed in the very nature of this human organism that it wants to move towards well-being. Only there's been some very fundamental misunderstandings about how to get there. And because we cannot fathom, and because the teaching on letting go of craving is so counterintuitive, because in our lives, the way we've gotten little moments of happiness is to get what we want, to get rid of what we don't want. We get a little hit of happiness when we get something that we want. We get a little hit of happiness when we get rid of something that we don't want. And we think that's the best it can be. That's as good as it gets. But we start to look at what's actually going on there as we're wanting to hold on to something or wanting to get rid of something. That very action of that craving, that heart that is holding on or pushing away, right there already the system, the organism, is out of kilter. It's not in well-being. It's already out of whack. And yet it's kind of foregoing well-being in this moment for the hopes, in the hopes that it'll get a moment of happiness in a few minutes or in a few days. And so the practice of mindfulness and of effort, of mindfulness, of concentration, begins to expose these habitual ways of looking for happiness as being a sham, basically. That they are not in our organism's best interest. And as we begin to see that, as we begin to actually witness that, our organism begins to gravitate towards the open heart and begins to understand that when the heart is contracted, this is not the way to well-being. When the heart is open and more responsive, this is the way to well-being. And so our organism wants to head us to well-being, and when it gets more reliable information about what actually is supportive of well-being, the organism wants to head in that direction. And so this is the way these last three aspects of the Eightfold Path begin to transform us. They begin to shift our perspective. And then we begin to more experientially understand the wisdom that we borrowed at the beginning. When I borrowed the wisdom of this book that I got, you know, I had no idea of how it would unfold. But within only a few months, it was very clear to me how anger was suffering, and the heart was already beginning to let go of anger in some very fundamental ways, some very deep ways. Not that anger is gone in my life by any means at this point, but just that some very deep patterns and habits around anger began to loosen. So these are the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And the Buddha explored these not just as truths to be believed. They can be understood that way, and it's helpful to actually recognize what is the Buddha saying in these Four Noble Truths, because there's some wisdom there to understand and to orient to. But fundamentally, the practice that the Buddha shared, it is practice. It's not just simply adopting beliefs. And so he suggested that with each of these truths, there's something that we need to do, an action to be taken. So we need to understand suffering. And this is an understanding through this. Basically, the way I see these actions is that we apply the Eightfold Path to each of these truths. So we apply the Eightfold Path. We apply wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration to suffering in our lives. We turn our attention to the experience of suffering, the experience of stress, the experience of offness, because suffering is a kind of dramatic word, but the quality, what the teaching points to is a wide range of experience that qualifies as dukkha or suffering. The dukkha, the Pali word usually translated as suffering. It varies from the subtlest form of unease, of just, oh, things feel a little off, to very strong forms of suffering, of loss, of all of the ways in which we hurt each other in this world. So the looking, turning, bringing the Eightfold Path, wise understanding applied to suffering asks us to look at it, asks us to turn with wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration to the experience of suffering as it's happening. What is the experience of frustration? Rather than being focused outwards on what we're frustrated about, turning to the human experience. What does it mean to be a human being that's experiencing this struggle? That's what it means to apply the Eightfold Path to this First Noble Truth. And that will help us to understand suffering. Understand suffering. Not just think about it, but turn towards it with our mindfulness and stability of mind to begin to understand it from the inside. Not just what we think about it. And so understand suffering. The Buddha encouraged us to look at our suffering. Not to think about it, but to meet it with a heart of compassion and kindness. In a sense, I think of this movement of understanding suffering as being a way that we sit in the midst of our struggles with honor and dignity and begin to ask them, what are you about? Really, from the inside, what are you about? So this is this understanding suffering. The second noble truth, the action associated with it is to let go or release or abandon the craving that keeps this whole pattern of wanting things to be otherwise in place. And in my experience, a lot of that letting go happens not from a doing, not from saying, oh, I see how I want things to be other than they are. I'll stop wanting things to be other than they are, because good luck with that. You know, it just doesn't seem to work that way. But what can happen is as we understand suffering, as we turn with our mindfulness and our wise effort towards the experience of suffering, we begin, as I said, we begin to understand from the inside how painful it is and how unhelpful it is. And what the most of the way that I've seen this letting go of the wanting happen is because the system begins to let go, not because I choose to let go. That first action, understanding suffering, turning with wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration to our suffering, supports the letting go. And there are times when we can set things aside, when we can recognize, wow, the mind's really headed down the garden path here. Let me put my attention on something else because that's not going to be helpful. So there are times that we can make that shift. But often that's just a temporary fix. It hasn't really uprooted the movement towards that wanting. It's just temporarily giving us a respite from it. And that can be very, very helpful. So I don't want to downplay the helpfulness of that. But the true release of the wanting, in my experience, mostly comes through understanding, through experiential understanding. And when there is that release or that letting go of the patterns of heart that clutch and grasp, when the heart lets go of that, there's a experience of release. And this is the third noble truth. And the action associated with the third noble truth, it's possible to have a release from that suffering. And the action that we're encouraged to do is to recognize it, realize it, realize that release. And then cultivating the path, the fourth noble truth, the action we're asked to do is to cultivate these qualities of heart and mind that support our being able to have a new perspective. So when we think of cultivating the path, you know, I was exploring these actions associated with the Four Noble Truths, and to me, the actions of each truth naturally tumbles us into the action of the next one. As we understand suffering in a very deep way, it leads the system to begin to let go of the craving, the wanting things to be otherwise, wanting what has come to be otherwise. And as the system begins to let go, we realize the release of that. And so those are the actions associated with the first three noble truths. Understand suffering, let go of the craving, and realize the peace that comes from that letting go of craving. And then the fourth noble truth, cultivate the path. We can think about that cultivation of the path as being the usual way that we think about cultivating something, that we actively practice with it. And that is what we have to do. We have to learn the tools of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. We need to explore what it means to look from the perspective of wise understanding and have our actions motivated out of that. We may need to pick up the practices of wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood in relationship. And yet there's also a way in which the cultivation of the path can be seen as a natural outcome of these first three actions too. If we think about the analogy of a path, you know, a path in the woods. We follow a path, and the path is there because thousands of people have walked that path before. And so, in a way, we are able to walk that path because others have done it before us. And so, in fact, it is said that the person who has realized this release naturally lives the Eightfold Path. They are the path. They are walking that path very naturally. They don't have to try to do it. It's just the natural expression of the heart that has let go, that it engages in the world with wise understanding and wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. But it's not something we have to do, not something that has to be tried to be picked up. And so the outcome of the path You know, the path begins and ends, in effect, with the path, kind of. The outcome of the path is that we are cultivating the path by keeping it clear for those of us coming behind us, those people coming behind us. So we are cultivating the path at whatever stage of the practice we are in. So in some ways, I think this is very beautiful, this notion of the path of the practice being what is naturally arising or naturally happening as a result of the practice. To me, it means that the path of practice and the result of practice are not so different. We orient our hearts towards these tools of the Eightfold Path, but it's not to get somewhere other. There's a kind of a famous quote by Gandhi. He said, "There is no path to peace. Peace is the path." And in a kind of similar way, the path of our practice, cultivating these qualities of the Eightfold Path, it reflects the goal, the living of the Eightfold Path, the natural living of the Eightfold Path. And to me, I find this an inspirational approach to the Eightfold Path, that we model those people who are free in our practice of the Eightfold Path. And so the path reflects the goal, essentially. A free being will live in this world with a kind heart, a compassionate heart, a loving heart, and a wise heart. Not an indifferent heart, and certainly not a non-active heart. So those are some of my thoughts on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And there's a few minutes if there's any comments or questions about anything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you'd use the mic so others can hear you too.
Hi. So I've had this practice for, I'm guessing, maybe 6 years. I lost track. But what I find is that, you know, the peaceful path is natural now. I don't have to think about it. It just comes natural. And with that, it's really noticeable how many people just, they don't understand me. You know, I have a good friend at work. We take a walk. We talk about our lives and our problems. And, I mean, just,
it's very non-intuitive.
It's like I can't even explain it to somebody else, because I want to just sit with my feelings for a day or two till I sort them out. And she's ready to wrap them all up in a little box and put them in a certain category. And I find that I don't know how to explain to people that, you know, I try, but it's really noticeable how many people are just so afraid to sit and just be with whatever it is they're going through.
Yes, and that is exactly there's a quote that I didn't read, but this points exactly to the poignancy. This same kind of question came up at the time of the Buddha, and the question was: beings wish to live without hate, harming, hostility, or enmity. They wish to live in peace, yet they live in hate, harming one another, hostile, and as enemies. By what fetters are being bound that they live in such a way? And it's just this, basically a fear of turning towards the experience because it's so, well, it's counterintuitive that it would be helpful, and everything we've learned is act on those fears because then I can fix something or change something and it will be better, if only for a second. And so that's the only way that people have learned to navigate the world. And so you're very fortunate to have heard the Dharma.
And their brains move so fast. Like they're always, they're constantly wrapping themselves around something to try and make sense of it. And I'm like, well, just chill out a minute, you know, but...
And what I would encourage is to demonstrate by example rather than by trying to explain.
I'm doing my best.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, your example speaks a lot, mm-hmm. you know, and you're saying that there's so much more natural gravitation towards peace. I mean, it may be that people are kind of drawn to you because they think you must know something, and you know, and yet, you know, the message is not one that people can easily hear. Mm-hmm. It's almost more if they begin to say, you know, something like, wow, you seem pretty calm. How do you do that?
Yeah, or gee, you haven't talked in the last 10 seconds. You know
what I mean? Well, see, that's from the old perspective. You know, that one's coming from the old perspective. But, I mean, partly too, you know, we have to have compassion because we see how much suffering is in that way of being. And so that's our work there too. If we can't, I mean, we can't be in fix-it mode for them, but we can have some sense of compassion for the struggle that they're going through. And that itself is a gift. Mm-hmm. The whole
and what's
things.
Really interesting is they're so unaware. They don't even know they're struggling. They just think they're organized and fixing everything.
That seems to be true too. Yep. Maybe time for one more, if there's anything else. Okay, why don't we just sit for a moment and just let the words go and see how you are in this moment. Sometimes at the end of a practice with a group of people, I like to make the wish that whatever benefits have come from this time together be offered to serve, to support the well-being, the happiness, the freedom of all beings everywhere. And I do see that this is not just a intellectual thing, because it does seem that as we slowly transform our hearts, that even just simple things like smiling at somebody in the grocery store has an impact on the world. And so may the benefits of our practice be of support to all beings everywhere. Thank you for your attention.